Welcome to today's reading of the Basin City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette, and it's entitled War in the Middle East, Multi-Faith Prayers Set. Community invited to come together to support peace. It's written by Alexander Schmidt of the Globe Gazette. Members of Mason City's interfaith community will host a public prayer for peace and restraint in response to the escalation of fighting in Gaza between Israel and the militant group Hamas. Addis Israel Synagogue of Mason City had previously scheduled a public prayer vigil at its regular Shabbat services Friday night, but was forced to cancel that event after the congregation felt they could not guarantee the public safety. The group decided that those of all faiths would be welcome and agreed to reschedule the event, now to be held at noon Saturday, October 28th, in Central Park. Local faith leaders from the Jewish, Muslim, and Christian communities will lead those attending in prayer and discussion on the impact of the war, particularly on the unfolding humanitarian crisis. Tracy Smith is a member of First Congregational United Church of Christ in Mason City and has been attending Torah study at Addis Israel since the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in the year 2018. Quote, I know we don't usually, but because of last night, is it okay if we open in prayer, end quote, Smith said Saturday morning. She goes on to say, I was praying myself last night, but I was alone, end quote. Smith displayed a Star of David pin on her shirt in solidarity. She said she would go to Israel and fight, quote, if I weren't grounded, end quote, as she pointed to her oxygen tank on the floor. She goes on to say, this is the most interesting part of my month, she said, of the Torah study. My faith means that I'm not afraid to die. For me, it's a promotion, end quote. In this week's Torah study, Rabbi Michael Libby, lay leader at Addis Israel, agreed that times are a bit troublesome. The Reverend Burton Everest of First Congregational Church led the opening prayer, saying, quote, we pray that the disaster in Israel and Gaza might soon end as peacefully as possible. We pray for wisdom for the nations to work well and establish a true peace. End quote. The Reverend Leanne Clausen DeMonts is ordained in the Presbyterian faith but preaches at a Methodist congregation. She spent 3 years in Israel as a human rights worker and is devastated by the violence currently engulfing the Holy Land. Quote, I consider both our local synagogue and our local mosque as friends, end quote, said DeMonts. I personally do not see, after 75 years of Arab-Israeli conflict, a military resolution to the conflict. I think the only resolution to the conflict is going to be one that is based on human rights and ensuring that everyone who does live in the Middle East has housing, food, and opportunity for education and vocation, the simple means to life, end quote. Libby condemned the evil represented by Hamas's quest for Jewish eradication, turning to scripture to make a point on the depth of the evil the nation of Israel and Jews worldwide who wish for a national homeland are fighting against. Hamas is an Arabic acronym for Harakat al-Maqawama al-Islamiyah, which means the Islamic Resistance Movement. But Hamas is also an Arabic word that means zeal. The Hebrew meaning of chamas is violence, according to the Hebrew English volume of Reuben Al-Khalay's Hebrew English English Hebrew Dictionary. Cruelty and injustice are additional definitions, but not zeal, according to an article in the Wisconsin Jewish Chronicle. Senior Hamas official Mohammed Daif, in claiming responsibility for the October 7th attack on Jewish civilians, said, this is the day of the greatest battle to end the last occupation on earth, and claimed 5,000 rockets had been launched during the initial coordinated attack against Israeli targets. Hamas has rejected Israeli sovereignty since its character in 1988, referring to Jews worldwide as the Zionist enemy. Quote, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. A forewarning for evil, said Libby. David Steger is a hospice chaplain in Mason City who also spent time in Israel. Quote, I'm just so sad. I've seen the non-militant Palestinian side of things, and I don't like the way they are being treated, end quote, he said. He goes on to say, I think Israel has a policy of mass incarceration with their settlements in the West Bank, before Smith interjected. Excuse me, they lost the West Bank in the Six-Day War, said Smith, referring to the 1967 conflict that ended with Israeli control over territory previously occupied by Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. They, the Arabs, are allowed to stay, end quote. They, the Arabs, are allowed to stay, but they're treated like second-class citizens, said Steger. Gaza is basically an open-air prison. Demont said she realized the geopolitical nuances of the conflict aren't going to be solved here in rural Iowa. She hopes community members of all faiths gather to show their support on Saturday for a peaceful end to the conflict and hope their prayers are heard. There are civilians, and then there are armed combatants, Demont said. I am with the civilians. Next, Iowa Works hosts weekly hiring events. This is written by Robin McClellan of the Globe Gazette. The Iowa Works Mason City office at 600 South Pierce Avenue hosts weekly hiring events Tuesday in the Job Center to connect job-ready candidates with area employers who are hiring. Employers from the area participate, and all interested applicants are encouraged to attend. Quote, there's never been a greater time to re-enter the workforce, and these weekly hiring events will help showcase the wide variety of positions available in our area, end quote, said Sarah Cook, business engagement consultant for Iowa Workforce Development within the Iowa Works Mason City Center. Quote, our weekly hiring events are often the first step to re-employment or even new careers in high-demand fields. Iowa Works stands ready to help any job seeker find the connection they need to get started, end quote. Tuesday's event features Iowa State University Extension and Outreach Sarah Gordo, now hiring an office manager from 1 to 3 p.m. For more information, contact Iowa Works at area code 641-422-1524. United Way North Central, Iowa to hold Kids Coach Drive. This comes from the Globe Gazette staff. United Way of North Central Iowa will hold a children's coat distribution November 15th in Mason City, according to a press release. Distribution is from 4 to 7 p.m. Coats can be picked up at Music Man Square, located at 308 South Pennsylvania Avenue in Mason City. Coats are first come, first served, and children must be in attendance to try on coat. No sizes will be held. United Way of North Central Iowa will accept donations of new or gently used children's winter coats until November the 10th. Donations can be dropped off at the United Way office located at 520 South Pierce Avenue, Suite 204 in Mason City. For more information about United Way of North Central Iowa, please contact at area code 641-423-1774 or visit the website at www.unitedwayNCI.org. Deferred judgment for Charles City woman. This is written by Matthew Rezeb of the Globe Gazette. A Charles City woman who originally faced up to 30 years in prison for drug and theft charges received two deferred judgments on Monday in Cerro Gordo County District Court. According to court records, 48-year-old Julie Jean Vance pleaded guilty to prohibited act, Schedule 4 or 5 controlled substance and second-degree theft in August. She was originally charged with the Class B felony of prohibited act, Schedule 1, 2, or 3 controlled substance. Court papers state that Vance committed prescription drug fraud between January and July of the year 2021 at Walgreens in Mason City. She also allegedly used an unauthorized credit card between June of 2019 and February of 2021. According to the plea agreement, Vance charged approximately $550 to the account. The affidavit accuses Vance of using unauthorized checks, withdrawals, and personal account payments totaling more than $1,500, but less than $10,000. That brings us to an article entitled GOP Fall Festival of Candidates Set for October 26th at Surf Ballroom. This is written by Robin McClelland. The Cerro Gordo County GOP is holding its Fall Festival of Candidates at the Surf Ballroom and Museum on Thursday, October the 26th, with keynote speaker Donald Trump Jr. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. and the presentation begins at 6:30 p.m. The Republican Central Committees of Cerro Gordo, Hancock, Winnebago, Worth, Mitchell, Franklin, and Floyd counties have invited presidential candidates or their representatives to attend. Committee members are still fielding responses, but have confirmed that Donald Trump Jr. will be the keynote speaker, with Governor Asa Hutchinson, a Republican from Arkansas, presidential candidate Ryan Binkley, and State Representative Henry Stone, representing Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican from Florida, in attendance. Local legislators will be on hand as well. The evening features catered heavy hors d'oeuvres, a cash bar, and local Dixieland band Raiders of the Lost Ark will play throughout the night. Tickets are $75 for table seats and $55 for booth seats, and can be purchased online at www.eventbrite.com. A reserved table for eight is $600 and can be reserved through email at cerrogordocogop@gmail.com. All money raised will go to the local GOP committees to support local candidates and grow the Republican Party. Thornton man accused of ramming vehicle while carrying two children in his truck. This is written by Matthew Rezeb. A Thornton man has been arrested after allegedly ramming another vehicle in a Clear Lake parking lot while two children and a woman were in his truck. According to court records, 33-year-old Michael Wayne Rother has been charged with two counts of child endangerment, second-degree criminal mischief, domestic assault, reckless driving, and obstruction of emergency communications. The affidavits state that around 9:30 p.m. on October the 17th, Rother and the owner of the other vehicle got into an argument in the back parking lot of 417 Main Avenue. Rother was driving a 2011 Ford F-250 with a woman inside, along with a 3-year-old child and a 6-year-old child. The woman allegedly told Rother she was calling the police when a struggle started, ending with Rother taking her phone and smashing it on the ground and with his foot. The damage to the vehicle that was rammed is estimated to be between $1,500 and $10,000. An arrest warrant was served on Wednesday and no contact order was put into place on Thursday. Rother was being held on $10,000 bond in the Cerro Gordo County Jail as of Friday morning. Second-degree criminal mischief carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison, and the child endangerment charges can carry up to 2 years each. Ella Taylor Dinner at Prime and Wine. North Iowa Republican women will hold the inaugural Ella Taylor Dinner at 5 p.m. Tuesday, October the 24th, at the Prime and Wine, 3000 4th Street Southwest. The formation of early Iowa Republican women's clubs began in the year 1928 by Ella C. Taylor, one of Iowa's first female newspaper columnists. She lived in Tama County, home of the first Republican women's club in Iowa. Taylor was an Iowa delegate to the Republican National Convention in the year 1924. Attorney General Brenna Byrd will be the guest speaker. She will be joined by local law enforcement for an evening emceed by former Iowa House Speaker Linda Uppmeyer. Human trafficking, fentanyl, and scams against senior citizens will be discussed. Tickets are $25 per person. Please call NIRW President Barb Hovland at area code 641-423-5389 to reserve your seat or contact any NIRW member. You may also email info@nirw.gmail.com. Next is a story entitled Energy Prices Ramping Up, but Local Assistance is Available. It's written by Robin McClelland of the Globe Gazette. Alliant Energy recently proposed a rate increase that would start in October of the year 2024. For those living paycheck to paycheck, the planned increase is an added stress on an already tight budget. The Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program is a federally funded program used by 6.7 million Americans to reduce their energy cost burden. Funds are granted to states like Iowa, which then disperse the money to local agencies. In North Iowa, it's North Iowa Community Action Organization that assists family with a one-time payment made to a heating or fuel company to supplement the cost of heating bills. Quote, it's a way of taking control of your finances using energy assistance. It can help free up money in the budget, end quote, said Mitch Kieran, Public Relations Resource Development Director at NICAO. The program runs through the coldest parts of the year. The Iowa Utility Board regulates when energy services can be disconnected. Due to the region's weather patterns, energy utilities cannot be disconnected between November 1st and April 30th. While utilities may not be switched off, bills continue to accumulate. LIHEAP is a supplemental assistance program, meaning it's not designed to pay for total costs of energy in the home. It is one-time payment calculated based on income, household size, type of energy used, and square footage. For families with a balance going into the heating season, it could mean weight off their shoulders. Others find balances grow over the course of the winter and need help paying it off before disconnections resume in April. Amy Rice, Client Resource and Energy Assistance Coordinator for NICAO, says families must apply each year. Quote, sometimes people think they only need to apply once and it carries over. You need to apply each year, end quote, she said. She goes on to say anyone who is income eligible should apply. Those funds will wait in your account until you use them, and if you don't need them, they'll be sent back to us for use for another household, end quote, Rice added. Enrollment begins in October for those 60 and over, disabled residents, and those in crisis. As of November 1st, any eligible household may apply. The deadline for applications is April 30th, giving families time to assess their situation and receive assistance for a crisis situation. Eligibility is based on the prior year's income and guidelines state families earning up to 200% of the federal poverty level qualify. A single person earning up to $27,180 is eligible, and a family of four can earn up to $55,500 and still qualify for assistance. There is also a crisis program available for homeowners with non-operational furnaces. The program allows for repair or replacement depending on circumstances and can even provide space heaters until heating has been restored. NICAO offers multiple ways to apply. Apply in person at 100 First Street Northwest, Suite 140, Mason City. Online at app.lihepia.net. Or download a printable application at nicao-online.org/energy-assistance. NICAO serves North Iowa with regional offices in Butler, Cerro Gordo, Floyd, Franklin, Kossuth, and Winnebago counties. Call 1-800-873-1899 with questions. Now it's time for today's obituaries. First, Cindy Leanne Hood of Rolla, Missouri. Cindy Leanne Hood, age 61, of Rolla, Missouri, passed away on Thursday, September the 21st, 2023, at home after an 18-month battle with cancer. A visitation and a celebration of life service will be held at the Christ Church, 710 North Kentucky Avenue, Mason City, 50401. The visitation will be on Friday, October the 27th, from 5 to 7 p.m., with the celebration of life service held on Saturday, October the 28th, at 10:30 a.m. Cindy was born on February 26, 1962, in Belmond, Iowa, to Arlen G. and Marjorie M. Ziegler. Cindy grew up and graduated from the Meservey-Thornton High School in 1980. From her marriage to Larry Hartema, they welcomed their two children, Jeremy in 1986 and Ashley in 1989. Cindy became a Christian through her rehabilitation at Life Changers, located in Rolla, Missouri. While at Life Changers, she met Clyde Michael Hood, who became the love of her life. They married on March 19, 2023. Cindy enjoyed her family, especially her grandkids. She liked to read and enjoyed diamond art. Linda K. Hoppel, 81, of Garner, died Saturday, October the 21st, 2023 at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, October the 26th, 2023 at Zion Lutheran Church in Clear Lake. Interment will be at Concord Township Cemetery in Garner. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, October the 25th at Cataldo Funeral Chapel, 160 East 4th Street, Garner, and will continue 1 hour prior to services at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials are preferred to the GHV Reading Buddies in memory of Linda. www.cataldofuneralhome.com. Next, Aurora M. Lozano, age 87, of Mason City, died Wednesday, October the 18th, 2023, at IOOF Home in Mason City. Funeral Mass of Christian Burial will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, October 28, 2023, at Holy Family Catholic Church. Officiating will be Reverend Neil Monternack. Visitation will be Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Fullerton Funeral Home, 123 2nd Street Southeast in Mason City. A rosary will be said at 6:30 p.m., followed by a parish wake service. Interment will be in Elwood St. Joseph Cemetery, Mason City. Services will be live streamed at epiphanyparish.org. Full obituary, services, and picture may be found on the funeral home website at fullertonfh.com or Facebook/Fullerton Funeral Homes. Fullerton Funeral Home, 123 2nd Street, Southeast Mason City, Iowa, 50401, phone number 641-423-8676. Rose M. Tucker, age 99, of Cresco, died on Thursday, October the 19th, at home with her son Bill by her side and the help of dedicated services from the Howard County Community Hospice team. Their help was much appreciated. A graveside service is planned for 11 a.m. Monday, October the 23rd at Evergreen Cemetery in Rudd, Iowa, with Pastor Sue Simmons presiding, with Chester's cremated remains being buried with Rose. Hint, Hudak Funeral Home is assisting the family. Phyllis W. Preftakes died Thursday, September 21st, 2023 at Heritage Care Center in Mason City. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. with a 1 hour prior visitation on Friday, October the 27th, 2023. Interment will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery. Those planning an expression of sympathy may wish to consider memorials to Wesley United Methodist Church in Mason City. Phyllis was born on January 29, 1931 in Mason City, the daughter of Delbert E. and Jenny L. Arndt Wagner. She graduated from Mason City High School and was employed at Northwestern Bell Telephone Company for 32 years. She was united in marriage to Alex Preftakes on August 23rd of 1954. To this union was born two children. They lived in Mason City. She was a member of Wesley Methodist Church and the Telephone Pioneers. Phyllis enjoyed golfing, playing cards, cross-stitch, crafting, cooking, and spending time with family. Fullerton Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 123 2nd Street Southeast in Mason City, Iowa, is handling the arrangements. They can be reached at 641-423-8676 or www.fullertonfh.com. That brings us to sports. Top story, Eagles into next round. A sloppy win advances West Hancock in playoffs. Written by Nate Thomas of the Globe Gazette, and the dateline is Brit. Class A number 6 West Hancock was more focused on the mistakes than the good after defeating Lamar's Gellin 38-22 at home on Friday night in the first round of the playoffs. A blocked punt, fourth down conversions, and a late turnover were all causes for concern for Coach Mike Sanger afterward. The win, though, fairly convincing. The Eagles rushed for 394 yards and played solid defense throughout against a solid Gallen team. Wes Hancock looked the part of a state championship contender for stretches. It was the chunks of the game that were not as pretty that stuck out to Sanger. Quote, I think it's good to get the first one under your belt because it is postseason and it's a whole different season, end quote, Sanger said. He goes on to say, it's a lot more intense. You have to settle down and do things the right way. Otherwise, good teams will expose you. And they did, end quote. Down 14-6, Gallen took over in the red zone after blocking a West Hancock punt. The Jays even got inside the one-yard line on the drive. But after a false start penalty wiped out a surefire touchdown, the Eagles came up with a big stop on fourth down to force a turnover. Kellen Smith shed a block to stop a scrambling Cole McCarty at the two-yard line. Wes Hancock moved the ball for a few plays, took a few penalties, but eventually Mitchell Smith broke the game open with a 75-yard run and a four-yard touchdown a few plays later to close out the first half. The game never got back within one possession, and it seemed to provide a small spark for West Hancock to pull away. Here's a rundown of some of the sports available on television today at 6 p.m. on the CBS Sports Network. In college football, it's New Mexico State at Louisiana Tech. At 6:30 p.m. on ESPNU, it's Liberty at Western Kentucky. Major League Baseball on TBS, it's the NLB and National League Championship Series, Game 7 between the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Philadelphia Phillies. And if you didn't see it last night, the Rangers defeated the Astros to make it to the World Series in the American League. NBA basketball, 6:30 p.m. on TNT, it's the Los Angeles Lakers at the Denver Nuggets. And on 9 p.m. on TNT, it's the Phoenix Suns at the Golden State Warriors. NHL on ESPN at 5 p.m., Toronto at Washington, 7:30 p.m. on ESPN, Boston at Chicago, and 10 p.m. on ESPN, it's Philadelphia at Vegas. That concludes the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for today. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I am your reader, Scott Splavik. Now we'll move on to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Our first story is entitled Friends Caring for Friends. Dayton Nonprofit will care for pets anywhere in Iowa. The Best Friends Project realizes the roles that pets play in an individual's speedy recovery, so its goal is to make sure owners and best friends do not get separated. If an individual doesn't have friends or family able to step in and watch their pet while in treatment for mental health or substance abuse, they are normally taken by animal control to a designated shelter or pound. Once the owner is out of treatment, that individual is then responsible for paying to get their pet. Often, the owner is unable to afford to pay for the bill. The Best Friends Project is a new nonprofit in Dayton, willing to drive to any community in Iowa to pick up a beloved pet and care for them while their owner gets the care they need. Owners can feel confident that their best friends are being well cared for during their recovery at the Best Friends Project at the Dayton Doggy Dude Ranch. As an animal lover, but also a person with experience with mental illness that has used my experience to become a peer support specialist and mental health advocate, this project has become more than a passion of mine. It has become my determination, and I am determined to watch it succeed, said Sarah Peters, project coordinator. Peters already owned the Dayton Doggy Dude Ranch, which is a dog boarding facility and doggy daycare. I had the building, I have the training, and I realized I had the capability of making a difference, she said. The project does not change how she does her original business. The boarding at the Dude Ranch is what helps provide income to maintain the building and pay expenses. Boarding with us at the Dude Ranch is a wonderful way to support the Best Friends Project, added Peters. Since beginning in the summer, the Best Friends Project has received about one call per week and has been sheltering animals anywhere between 30 days and 6 months. The response we have received since the beginning of August has shown that the project is not only needed in our state, but is long overdue, said Peters. The project also benefits Dayton by bringing more attention to the rural community. Do you ever hear people say, "Where is Dayton?" asked Peters. We hear it all the time at the community outreach events we attend promoting our program. Our answer is always, Dayton is in the heart of North Central Iowa, and it's not just the home to the Dayton Rodeo, but also the Dayton Doggy Dude Ranch. As part of its outreach program, Peters has been able to set up informational booths at different events throughout Iowa. At those events, they are then able to hear firsthand from peers who could have benefited from these services had they been available during their treatment. Some even lost their pets. It is truly touching and heartbreaking. It is what drives us to keep this project going, said Peters. Imagine if you lost your pet during a hospital stay. How would that affect you? Now imagine that hospital stay was for mental health or substance use recovery. Many peers stated that finding care for their best friends was a reason they delayed treatment or hesitated to get help, including the peers that they are currently assisting through their program. The Fort Dodge Community Foundation has given the project a community impact grant of $5,000. This grant is made available through the Grow Green County Gaming Corp in Jefferson, which provides the Fort Dodge Community Foundation with grant funds for the purpose of improving the quality of life in communities in Fort Dodge and Webster County. The Best Friends Project is spreading the word about its services through the Department of Health and Human Services, Unity Point Health, and other organizations that assist with providing treatment for mental health or substance abuse. The project is normally contacted by caseworkers, law enforcement, or a peer-run program at a treatment facility. If an individual or family reaches out about care, they will need to provide verification that the pet's owner is going into treatment. The service is also extended to those who are actively involved in a treatment program, also known as integrated home health, and receive care on a daily basis. There's no application to fill out. They just need to meet those requirements, and then we can come in and we just have them fill out a form giving us permission to care for their pet, including veterinarian care, Peters said. For more information about the Best Friends Project, call Peters at area code 515-715-7266. Next is an article entitled, Fort Dodge Schools Enrollment Down for Third Year in a Row. Porter said slight decline was expected. For the third year in a row, enrollment at the Fort Dodge Community School District has declined. Superintendent Josh Porter presented the certified enrollment update to the FDCSD Board of Education on Monday. This year, enrollment in the district has gone down by about 40 students, he said, adding that the district is down by a couple hundred over the last 5 to 6 years. The positive is we rebounded a little bit. We were down about 98 the year before, and now we're only down about 40, Porter said. He said the Every Student Succeeds Act, passed by the Iowa legislature and signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds in January, which provides state taxpayer funding to send K-12 students to private schools, may have had some impact on those numbers. We anticipated we'd maybe have a little bit of a drop based on just the data we collected from October till May of last year, he said. Porter attended the Urban Education Network meeting last week, and he said every school district on the call had a drop in enrollment. Honestly, it's much, much worse than Fort Dodge's situation, he said. The work to address enrollment decline at Fort Dodge started as the school year started, Porter said. The total certified enrollment for this year is 3,520 students in preschool through 12th grade. Sports Pavilion Plan Advances is the title of our next article. Fort Dodge Council seeks EPA grant for Warden Plaza. The creation of a building in which people could play basketball and pickleball got a boost from the Fort Dodge City Council Monday. The council voted to include the site of the proposed sports pavilion at Corridor Plaza into the Center City and Industrial Park urban renewal areas. Doing so makes it possible for the city to use tax increment financing to provide financial aid to the project. On September the 11th, the council voted to declare its intent to enter a development agreement with M&M LLC of Ankeny, which is the company planning to build the sports pavilion. The proposed terms of the agreement call for the city to provide $2.65 million from a bond issue next year, plus five annual payments of $275,000 beginning in the year 2026. Chad Schaefer, the city's chief development officer, said the agreement with M&M LLC will spell out exactly what the developer must do to get the money. Councilman Terry Monke was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to approve the measure. The 200 by 250 foot facility will sit on the west side of Corridor Plaza on ground that has long been identified as the spot for a pavilion and plaza. Its entrance will face east. Inside, there will be four basketball courts, three pickleball courts, and a microbrewery restaurant. The developer, not the city, will operate the facility. The pavilion's cost has been estimated at $13 million. In other business, the council approved the second reading of a measure rezoning property on the Fort Dodge Country Club golf course for residential use. The measure must be approved one more time to become law. The council also applied for a $4.25 million grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to help pay for cleaning up the Warden Plaza at 908 First Avenue South. The money would be spent to remove asbestos and lead-based paint from the vacant downtown edifice. City officials will learn in May of the year 2024 if the grant will be awarded. Next up, clubhouse manager added at Lakeside. Council approves a new position. A clubhouse manager will be added to the staff of Lakeside Municipal Golf Course as a result of Fort Dodge City Council action Monday. Quote, "This is a big facility out there and it needs attention, the attention it deserves," end quote, said Lori Branderhorst, the director of Parks and Recreation and Forestry. The clubhouse manager position was one of several new jobs proposed early this year when the preparation of the $153 million budget for the fiscal year that began July 1st was underway. Additional employees for the police department, fire department, and Fort Dodge Regional Airport were rejected on the grounds that there would not be enough tax revenue to pay for them. The clubhouse manager position was left in the budget because there was enough anticipated golf course revenue to pay for it. City manager David Fierke said Monday that even though money for the position flows through the general fund, only revenue generated by the golf course will be used to pay for it. The clubhouse manager would have a starting salary of about $47,000. The golf course budget for the current fiscal year is $687,612, with anticipated revenue of $703,606. A part-time position at the course is being eliminated. Branderhorst said there used to be two full-time managers at the course, a clubhouse manager and a grounds manager. The clubhouse manager position was eliminated. Then, following a retirement, the grounds manager ended up in charge of the golf course and Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex. Quote, "We really need someone in there every day managing it," end quote, Branderhorst said. Councilman Terry Monke was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to establish the position. Colander man convicted Monday of sexual abuse. Hill faces up to 72 years in prison. A Webster County jury found a Colander man guilty of several counts of sexual abuse and child endangerment after a week-long trial that ended Monday. Joseph Daniel Hill, age 27, was found guilty of two counts of second-degree sexual abuse, four counts of child endangerment resulting in injury, and one count of child endangerment. The jury acquitted him of one count of second-degree sexual abuse and four counts of sexual exploitation of a minor. In total, Hill faces up to 72 years in prison in order to serve if ordered to conserve consecutive sentences. For each of the second-degree sexual abuse charges, Hill faces up to 25 years in prison. For the four counts of child endangerment resulting in bodily injury, he faces up to 5 years in prison. The fifth count of child endangerment is an aggravated misdemeanor and carries a prison term of up to 2 years. Hill was arrested in May of the year 2022 after an investigation by the Webster County Sheriff's Office, which was prompted by a call from the Department of Human Services. According to a press release sent out at the time, interviews with the juvenile victims provided information about a series of physical and sexual abuse, and the children were removed from the residence by DHS. He was initially charged with 3 counts of second-degree sexual abuse, a Class B felony, and 5 counts of child endangerment resulting in bodily injury, a Class D felony. In July of the year 2022, additional charges were filed against Hill, including 2 additional counts of child endangerment causing bodily injury and 2 counts of assault while participating in a felony, all Class D felonies. He was also charged with 4 counts of possession of a depiction of minor in a sexual act, all aggravated misdemeanors. Through the course of pretrial proceedings, the charges against Hill were amended twice. The final slew of charges he faced at trial were 3 counts of second-degree sexual abuse, 6 counts of child endangerment resulting in bodily injury, and 4 counts of sexual exploitation of a minor. A sentencing hearing will be scheduled. In November of the year 2022, Hill's girlfriend, Michelle McMullen, then age 28, pleaded guilty to 4 counts of child endangerment resulting in bodily injury. Investigators alleged that she knew of the abuse her children received under Hill's care and failed to report it. McMullen was sentenced to 5 years in prison for each count to be served concurrently with one another. According to the Iowa Department of Corrections website, McMullen was released from prison on supervised release on October the 16th. She is scheduled to be discharged from supervision on October 16th of the year 2028. Sunday blaze destroys Fort Dodge apartments. 8 families lose their home, no one injured. 8 families were displaced this weekend after an early morning fire destroyed most of an apartment building on Fort Dodge's west side on Sunday. According to the Fort Dodge Fire Department, a fire was reported at about 1:19 a.m. at 332 Avenue M West in the Westridge Townhomes. When fire crews arrived, they found occupants escaping the building with heavy fire conditions on the rear of Unit 332. A third alarm was called to bring additional fire department resources to the scene. Fire crews launched an aggressive attack along with search and rescue operations using 3 hose lines. According to the Fort Dodge Fire Department, the fire was brought under control at about 3 a.m., though crews remained to extinguish hot spots throughout the building until about 7:30 a.m. The apartment building contained 8 units with 14 occupants and several pets. 5 of the units suffered serious fire, smoke, and water damage. The remaining 3 units sustained smoke and water damage. No injuries were reported, and the Red Cross is assisting the occupants displaced by the fire. The cause of the fire is still under investigation by FDFD investigators along with the State Fire Marshal's Investigation Office. Fort Dodge firefighters were assisted by the Fort Dodge Police Department and Mid-American Energy. Now it's time to read the obituaries. Nancy Jo Hewitt is our first obituary. She was age 80, passed away Saturday, October 21st, 2023 at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Thursday at the Tompkins Celebration Center at Friendship Haven. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. on Thursday at the Tompkins Celebration Center. Burial will be in North Lawn Cemetery. Gunderson Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Nancy Jo Johansson Hewitt, the daughter of Arlo and Carita Votman Johansson, was born January 7, 1943 in Estherville, Iowa. She attended Ringsted High School and graduated in 1961. She always wanted to be a nurse and graduated from Broad Lawn School of Nursing in 1964. Nancy married her high school sweetheart, Dennis Hewitt, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Ringsted, Iowa, on September the 20th of 1964. They were blessed with sons Mark and Matt. They moved to Fort Dodge in 1969. Nancy was a registered nurse and worked in various hospitals in communities where her husband taught physics. She excelled at her work and loved helping people. She was a nurse at the hospital in Fort Dodge, called Bethesda Hospital at that time, on the medical surgical ward and later on the obstetrics floor, which she loved. After her hospital work, Nancy was the office nurse for Dr. James Reed, and she retired in the year 2001. Nancy enjoyed many fishing trips with her husband and their 2 boys. She also enjoyed going to their boys' sporting events. Nancy was an avid paper crafter and sent many handmade cards to family and friends over the years. She was a member of Christ Lutheran Church. She is survived by her husband, Denny, sons Mark and of Omaha and Matt of Fort Dodge, grandchildren Morgan McCoy of Phoenix, Arizona, Elizabeth Sundberg of Noah Hewitt and Mason Hewitt, all of Omaha, and Ryland Hewitt of Fort Dodge, and great-grandchildren Charlotte and Miles of Phoenix. She's preceded in death by her parents, grandparents, Axel and Anina Votman, and Peter and Anna Johansson, and several aunts and uncles. She was a loving wife, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and will be greatly missed. Dennis M. Eschelberger, age 80, of Otho, Iowa, died October 21, 2023. Services will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family, and it's being handled by Bruce's Funeral Home, which can be found at www.brucesfuneralhome.com. Lambert J. Clock of Rockwell City died October the 21st. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday at St. Francis Catholic Church in Rockwell City. Visitation is 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday at Palmer and Swank Funeral Home. Rhonda Vaughn, age 86, of Fort Dodge. Services will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday, October the 26th at Gunderson's Funeral Home. For more information, you can go to www.gundersonfuneralhome.com. Now we'll move on to sports and our top story. St. Edmund falls to AGWSR in semis. Dateline is Ackley. St. Edmund was in the driver's seat early, but wasn't able to put AGWSR away in a Class 1A regional semifinal on Monday night. This is regarding volleyball. The Gaels, with a record of 9-25 overall, won the first set 25-19, but the Cougars, with a record of 18-23, captured the next three sets 25-9, 25-16, and 26-24. Going into the season, we knew there was some potential, said St. Edmund head coach John Johnson. We struggled to battle for every point in the first part of the season, but in the last half, we won some tight matches and tight sets. We lost a lot of deciding sets, but we were there having a chance as we finished the season. We had a sense of urgency, and we learned a lot. In the fourth game, the Gaels had a strong rally after trailing 11-3 and cutting the margin to 15-11. St. Edmund went on an 8-4 run to tie the contest at 19-19. With the Gaels trailing 19-16, Ava Andrew served three straight points, including back-to-back aces, to tie the contest. We played a solid fourth set, Johnson said. We started out behind and got back in it. Ava Andrew did a good job, and we were able to get ahead after that. We battled and showed a lot of heart. After the Gaels were able to tie it at 21-21 and 22-22 before taking their final lead of the game at 23-22. The score was knotted at 24-24 when the Cougars closed out with two straight points. St. Edmund jumped out right away, earning the first set victory. We played a lot of good first sets, Johnson said. We were able to jump ahead and keep them out of rhythm. Entering the match, AGWSR hadn't lost a set in the postseason, and the Gaels had only lost one. It was the last match for St. Edmund senior Abby Lawler. Abby did a great job this year after playing a little last year. She got after it, Johnson said. We only lose one senior, but most of our conference opponents lose two, three, or four. We had three freshmen that saw some playing time, and the younger kids did a great job of pushing the upperclassmen in practice and matches. Next year could be a special season for St. Edmund's volleyball. Lynx draw 3A home game. For six area schools, the playoffs roll on this coming Friday night. Emmitsburg, West Bend Mallard, and Bishop Garrigan were all winners this past week to advance, with Webster City, Humboldt, and Algona joining them this week. The Lynx, with a record of 7-2 overall, secured an automatic bid in Class 3A with a win over Humboldt, allowing them a home game against Nevada, with a record of 7-2. Also in 3A, the Wildcats with a record of 5-4 and Algona with a record of 6-3 secured spots in the field. Humboldt travels to Williamsburg, who has a record of 8-1, while the Bulldogs are at Sioux Center with a record of 8-1. Emmitsburg with a record of 7-2 welcomes in Sumner Fredericksburg with a record of 8-1 in a 1A tilt, while West Bend Mallard with a record of 7-2 heads to Anita Cam, and Bishop Garrigan with a record of 8-1 hosts defending state champion Remsen St. Mary's in 8-player action. The Wolverines and Golden Bears, who were district rivals, are now paired in the same pod and would meet in the next round with wins. This, of course, was all about football. Iowa Central falls on the road. This comes from Dodge City, Kansas. For the second consecutive week, the Iowa Central football team was downed by a ranked team from Kansas. Number 14 Dodge City erased a 10-point deficit to knock off the 9th-ranked Tritons here Saturday, 34-30. Iowa Central, with a record of 5-3 overall, was looking to bounce back after a loss at home to number 7 Butler and gain some momentum heading into a showdown this coming Saturday with 2nd-ranked Iowa Western. A 23-point second quarter had them well on their way to doing just that, as Mario Sanders caught a pair of touchdown passes from Justin Silverstein to get the Tritons back into the game as they took a 23-20 lead into the break. Silverstein finished the day with 337 yards passing and 4 touchdowns, as Sanders caught 9 passes for 150 with 3 scores. Javonte Williams had the other touchdown as Tavis Malloy hauled in 2 passes for 67 yards. Spencer Zinn rushed for 43 yards to lead the ground attack for the Tritons. For Dodge City, Trayvon Jefferson had 309 yards in the air and 4 scores, while Jalen Smith rushed 16 times for 178 yards and a touchdown. Curtis Reardon III had 6 receptions for 129 yards and 2 scores. Smith's 2-yard TD plunge to cap a 6-play, 97-yard drive with just over 5 minutes remaining in the game was the difference. Dan Knutson had 2 sacks on defense, with Branson Peters recording 8 tackles. Andre Porter, Marlon Dawson, and Malachi Bird all picked off a pass. End of the road. Dodgers say goodbye to senior class in finale. Fittingly, the last 2 players to leave Dodger Stadium field on Friday were Fort Dodge senior co-captains Ty Adams and Grant Williams. The longtime teammates and friends lingered behind for one final moment on their home turf together. They shared a long embrace and exited to a tearful goodbye. The 2023 finale didn't go as anyone in the FDSH football camp had hoped. Spencer dominated from start to finish, scoring its 3rd consecutive lopsided victory to end the season with an impressive 48-0 win over head coach Nick Moser's squad on an otherwise perfect evening. The Dodgers were, of course, disappointed in the final result, which closed the books on a 2nd straight 4-win, 5-loss campaign. Moser didn't want to spend much time dwelling on what happened in the here and now, though. He immediately shifted his focus to both the past and the future while appreciating his senior class and the present. The outcome against the Tigers is the outcome. This is about a much bigger picture, Moser said. This isn't what our seniors will be remembered for. They worked hard. They were consistent in their approach. They showed up and were selfless. They brought our culture back into a good place. I'm very proud of them for that. They put in the time and dedicated themselves to their teammates and this program. In the years to come, our current sophomores and juniors will carry that forward, and the 2023 seniors will have a stake in what happens here both on and off the field. That's going to mean a lot more than Friday's score. Nothing that happened last night changes my feelings about what they've meant to Dodger football. Returning first-team All-District standout Adrian Carrillo rushed 25 times for 228 yards and 3 touchdowns to power the Tigers, who dominated at the point of attack. After starting the season 0-6 with all 6 losses coming to playoff qualifiers, Spencer won its final 3 games by a combined point differential of 175-6. Fort Dodge, meanwhile, couldn't get out of its own way. The The Dodgers turned the ball over a season-high 6 times after holding a +5 aggregate turnover margin through the first 8 weeks of the year. Any semblance of a competitive second half was erased by a frantic final 15 seconds to close the second quarter. Spencer scored 2 back-breaking touchdowns, the first coming after a 4th-and-15 hook-and-ladder conversion, and the second on a Statue of Liberty run play as the clock hit 0 following a Fort Dodge kickoff fumble. Suddenly, a 17-0 uphill climb for the Dodgers was insurmountable at 31-0. The Tigers had 381 yards of total offense to FDSH's 54. Adams, Williams, fellow captains Cal Hartman and Drew Moritz, Caldwell, Pineda, Malachi Pettigrew, Drayton Miller, Parker Schillerstorm, Carson Smith, and Justin Krog suited up for the final time as Dodgers on Friday. Senior night festivities took place before kickoff for both the football team and the FDSH. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.